Hey everyone, welcome to My Two Cents with Tawanda Harris. This is a podcast dedicated to educators, for educators, and by educators. Yes, it's all about encouraging, it's all about sharing strategies, it's all about going on an educational journey with each other. You are not alone, and I hope that when you finish listening to this podcast, you feel like you went on a journey with educators around the world. Thank you for tuning in to My Two Cents. Happy Black History Month. I am so excited about this episode. I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Kim Parker and Arielle Johnson, also known as Miss J, and we talked about hashtag Black Boy Lit. Listen in as they drop some serious nuggets, their wisdom, their experience, all of those things that they are bringing to us as a gift in education is going to blow your mind. So make sure you have your pen and paper ready for all of the things that they are going to share. Enjoy. Okay, thank you all so much for tuning in today. I have two amazing guests, one being Dr. Kim Parker and the next being Arielle Johnson, who she's starting to be a regular on my show, which she is always, always welcome to do that. So I'm going to start off by allowing or asking them to share their teacher journey. Whoever wants to go first, you can.
I was going to let you go first because you're my elder.
That was shade. Go ahead, Miss J.
So, I come from a family of educators, and my grandmother was a physical education teacher for almost 40 years in Florida. My mom was a school-based speech therapist. My grandfather was an administrator, so I come from a very long line of education professionals. So actually, I was, of course, not going to do that, being who I am, the stubborn person that I am. I started as a pharmacy major, actually, and then I quickly became a journalism major, and then somewhere in there, I became an education major. It was just, you know, a calling that I had to fulfill, right? Like, that was the calling of my heart. So I have a lot of gratitude for that. I love spending my day, my life with children and with other educators. I can't imagine doing anything else.
I grew up in Kentucky on a farm, and then I came to teaching after doing a few other jobs. I worked in athletics. I worked for an internet startup, a high school sports internet startup, and then became a teacher after people had always said I should be a teacher, but I didn't want to do it because I always thought teachers would never make any money. But finally, it sort of took one person, a former boss, who said, you should think about this. And I did. I went to Boston College, did my teaching degree through an urban teaching program, and started teaching in the city and kept teaching. Then went to grad school because I was, on the urging of a really great mentor, Dr. Teresa Perry, who said, you are teaching and experiencing these really great things, right? Systems you're creating with Black kids. And you were asking really great questions. So essentially go to school, get your doctorate and sort of think about that. And so I did, and then came back to teaching. And so in capacities for the last almost 20 years now, which seems like astounding, I've been in schools. Now I work with pre-service teachers at an independent school, and still work with young people in the summers now, sort of one step removed, but have stayed pretty true to making sure that Black kids and other kids of color have access to literacy and can practice literacy in really powerful ways.
That's awesome. It's funny how, you know, and this has been a common trend of guests on the show where you all didn't start off in the teaching realm or wanting to be a teacher for whatever reason, but it's kind of like it pulls you in And, you know, as much as you want to fight it, it pulls you in and it's so fulfilling. I think about myself, I was the opposite. I remember being that cousin in my basement because my basement was set up like a classroom. Who does that, right? And so it was set up like a classroom. And so when my cousins would come over, I was the teacher. I would grade their papers with like red pen, and we had the carbon copy papers, sheets, and I would grade their papers. And so of course they didn't really want to hang out with me. I had to be about 7 or 8 years old. And I said, I'm going to be a teacher. So it's always interesting to hear the stories of how you all started in another path and then went to be these amazing educators that are just impacting so many lives of students and teachers as well. So thank you so much for sharing that. And I know, Dr. Kim Parker, you said that you're not necessarily in the classroom, but even in the summertime and just, you know, what you're doing with students. For the both of you all, how would you describe your classroom?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's so interesting to sort of think about where I started with teaching and sort of where I've evolved, because I would think when I first started, I started teaching in charter school. So I was very much about like discipline and control. And it was only really once I started to do my dissertation work to think about literacy, right? It's this sort of social, the ways we perform literacy to be in service and in responding to the world around us and to understand agency. I mean, to really think about if we really want to be collaborating with young people, then I had to change my practice. And so I'm never so much wedded to what I'm teaching. I'm much more wedded to who I'm teaching. And so that looks different, in whatever capacity we're gathering. I think that I work really hard to listen to them, to think about where they have past sort of negative experiences and trauma, and how can we work through that? And really, what does it take to create positive literacy environments with kids who, in many cases, have had awful experiences, awful teachers, haven't really been able to read books that they choose. And so, you know, I think when you get to a point where you can, like, you know your stuff, then you can sort of think really deeply about what's the lasting impact of the relationship with kids you're building, and then to go from there. So, I do much more listening now than I ever did. It's taken me a while to get there, but also to think about like, how do you co-construct the space with kids? And that's different every single time, but it's also the most worthwhile experience that I've done as a practitioner.
That what and how, I mean, that really just sticks out to me. You don't necessarily think about what you're teaching, but who you're teaching, and that those spaces differ based on who you're teaching, and really focusing in on the relationship piece and the agency that students have in there. That, thank you.
Yeah, and I think too that that's why I'm not so bent on teaching the same text year after year after year. Sure, there are some texts that will resonate with kids just because they are the text they are. But I think too that what's been nice is the flexibility of being able to change out whatever we're doing because of relevance and who's in front of you and, you know, what you need to do. And always, you know, like if it's a, you can make standards sort of align however you need them to align. So I think that we just need to think about that also.
Yes. You know, I'm in wholehearted agreement with Kim regarding the need for co-creation of your space with kids. I think that's so important. I try to strike a balance between assuring them from day one, from the moment they walk into our classroom, that this is a space for you, and this is a space for children. And so a lot of times I will leave up like student artwork or student quotes and those sorts of things from the year before, and then start to kind of change those out as the school year progresses. But, you know, I definitely believe that it's important for the space to really belong to the children, you know, I have a choice about whether or not I'm going to be there. Children, I think we so often forget, don't have a choice. They have to be there. They didn't choose me as their teacher. They didn't choose B2 as their classroom. And so I think it's really important that a choice in general in literacy and in, you know, seating, I have flexible seating and all those things. I think that choice is so important. It's important to honor that in our spaces. I think that, you know, I want to create a classroom that is, you know, representative of all that we hold as ideal, you know, in the society in which we live, right? I want a democratic classroom. I want a classroom that's full of love and incredible amounts of compassion. I want a classroom full of action, which means that it's super noisy sometimes. And I want, you know, I want a classroom where kids get to create things, right? And so I don't want to have a lot of things that are, for example, you know, I do have some math centers and, you know, those sorts of things available to kids, but there's always this space, right, where kids get to create their own math games or kids get to create their own literacy centers and those sorts of things, because I think, you know, having that agency is important, and also doing the cognitive work of creation is really important. So, but when I think about like what I would say my classroom is like, I kind of lean into what I hear other people say. I was just talking to someone the other day about how I don't think I'm a good like observer of myself. And so I rely on other people for that. And so one of my favorite memories is I have round tables in my classroom, and we have vases of fresh flowers on each table. And I change them out every Sunday when we're in person. Of course, we are not right now. And one day, our janitor came in to vacuum, and she said, "I just love how you have these beautiful arrangements in your classroom every single week. It's just so beautiful." She said, "It makes me feel like you think that your students are worthy of beauty."
Oh, wow.
And I was like, well, they are, right? And that is the message that I'm trying to, right? That's the message that I'm trying to into them. And so I think the other thing that stands out in my classroom is that like it's just overrun with books. Uh-huh. Like I steal bookcases from like everywhere in the school. I'm like asking the principal, "Hey, there's an empty bookcase in the staff development room. Can I have that? Oh, I saw an empty bookcase over there. Can I have that?" You know, so the teachers who don't want their bookcases anymore pass them on to me. So
like, don't worry, I can
have it. The other thing that stands out is just the number of books we have going on in there.
You know, just listening to both of your, the ways that you've described your classroom, it makes me think about how we as educators need to really rethink how we approach the beginning of the school year. How oftentimes I think of when the school year would start and you're getting ready for your students to come in, you unpack everything you have already packed in your closet before the summer, and you're literally pulling those things back out and putting them in some cases putting them in the same order, the same way that you had it, because it's easier. You have the same space, let me arrange it the same way. So often I have seen my colleagues do it, as well as I've heard teachers talk about, "Oh, it just took me a couple of days to get it right back the way it was." But what you all are saying is, no, that is not how that happens. If we are creating spaces for our students to have agency, and that our spaces are more so decided upon who we teach and not what we teach, then that whole approach of taking it back out the way it was last year goes out the door. How is it at the beginning of the year, or Dr. Parker, when you were in the classroom at the beginning of the year, what did that kind of look like?
It involved lots of talking to kids, right? Thinking about what are they bringing in. I think that those it's always time, the best time spent at the beginning is to get to know who's in front of you, and to like humanize yourself in front of them. I try to get them reading really quickly. So there's lots of like sort of going through, oh, tell me about your story. What can I learn? Try this book, lots of book pushing. And I think that it's that, right? Sort of how do we learn to trust each other? How do we talk to each other? How do we then begin to build community in a way that helps us know that we are responsible for each other, in ways that maybe they've not had before, or that is maybe familiar to them from past experiences, but they've been not so in practice, that we then need to make sure that we are on the same page, that we know how to talk to each other, how to love each other, and then also how to have like critical disagreements in ways that we're able to bring ourselves back together also.
Yeah, Kim is making me think a lot about, I think, you know, your question kind of made us go to the physical environment at first, but our classrooms are not just physical environments, right? They are social environments, they're emotional environments, they're intellectual environments. There are so many, you know, things that we could start to list out about what our classrooms are. And so, you know, I am, I think that's probably why we work together a lot, but Kim and I are in total agreement and alignment. You know, just, I would say it's been 3 or 4 years now. But after I read Carla Shalaby's Troublemakers,
That book.
You know, I just, like, I had always been like, oh, let's talk about what our rules should be. And you pretend like you are listening to them, but you actually already have the rules planned out and, you know, All of that. And I just stopped. I just said, you know what, guys, we have one rule in this classroom, and our rule is to be love. The end. Good. And so so that's what I've held on, you know, held on to for the past several years, is just, we have to be love to each other, to ourselves, to anyone who enters our classroom. And so, you know, starting at the beginning of the year, creating that environment where, first of all, we value you as an individual, and, you know, and doing that identity work at the beginning of the school year. And then also, I want you to value yourself, you know, within that identity work. And also, we value each other, and we also value other kinds of people who may not be here, you know, with us in our classroom. Our school tends to be pretty homogenous, ethnicity and race wise, but we do, you know, we do have a handful of kids who are not Latinx. And so, like, making sure, that we don't render kids invisible by not making them visible, you know, that, like, that's why I don't believe in a lot of, you know, polarization of things or dichotomies or things like that. But I really do believe that if you don't make children with intentionality visible, then you render them invisible in your classroom. And so just always being cognizant of what kind of space you're creating for every single child who is a part of your classroom environment. So, for example, you know, making an intentional choice about our read aloud for after this break that we're on right now, because I want to make sure that I'm always cycling through, like, all the kinds of people. So we're going to read, you know, that are in our class. And so we just read a book by Pam Munoz Ryan, and there were these, you know, such deep connections that, and this is online, that I had kids crying at the end of the book, right? They were so, they said, oh, my abuela sings me that lullaby, and, you know, all of those things. And then, so now we're like, you know, we're moving on to another read aloud, and we're going to read a book by a Vietnamese author. We have one Vietnamese child in our class, and she actually just told a volunteer not too long ago, after we read Eyes That Kiss in the Corners, she was talking about how much she loved that book and how wonderful it was. And she said, you know why, you know who I am. I'm Vietnamese. I came here from Vietnam. And sometimes I'm not proud of that, but that book made me proud of that. And so, you know, just being cognizant of the space that we're creating that's beyond the physical, I think is so important.
Yeah. And I mean, even when you started off by saying my only rule is it's centered in love, loving yourself, loving each other. I think for me, it automatically, you know, makes me think about just the humanity in it all. How oftentimes when classroom rules are created, they're black and white. And it's what is on paper. If you break this rule, this is the consequence, and we keep going. But when it comes to, you know, understanding that your students, that everyone in the classroom is valued, everyone is loved, you love everyone, all of those things come with seeing the humanity in the students that are before you. And so, you know, you're able to listen to other perspectives. You're able to be more accepting or understanding of, you know, someone's, what they're bringing to the table versus, nope, this is the rule and we keep going. I think that that is an awesome, that's an awesome rule to have.
Thank you. Just want to be a child in Ariel's class.
Oh my God.
And I mean, it's a shame that we live across the country, because I would just have my child in her class as long as every single year he would have Miss J. Yeah. I mean, I would then insist that Miss J teach upper elementary, middle school, and high school to keep, you know, so he could have her for 12 years. But I think that every child deserves such love and care. And I've been reading a lot of work lately from Gloria Ladson Billings, right? And so much of what is happening now, the theories are essentially culturally relevant pedagogy. And Miss J does that every single day. Like, we don't have a better example of what it looks like daily than her. I would like bet on it.
You know, my daughter, she is in middle school. And I just think, you know, how can I ship my daughter to Miss J so that she can be, even though Miss J is teaching third grade, it's okay. Jaden can be the helper. And then just pull her in a small group and teach her sixth grade.
That's right. Yeah. Because you also remember, exactly. And you mm-hmm. realize too, like, you know, we know all of the data about the impact of a Black teacher for Black children and non-Black kids.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know, like, I've just sort of always been impressed with what she gets these children to do, just because she expects them to. Mm-hmm. And then sort of leads them to their greatness that they always had.
So you hear that, Michelle?
Thank you, guys.
They're waiting. Come on, move on over.
You know, one of the things that I would say is, like, this has been, I mean, I don't accept compliments well, so just thank you. But also, this has been a journey, you know? I would say if you had met me, let's say I'm 23 years in now, so if you'd met me 15 years ago, you'd been like, she's a hot mess, right? Not, you know, in terms of what we're talking about and those particular issues right now. And so I think, like, it's just a testament to the need to do the personal work, right? And so for so long, I identified as Black, I don't have a choice. I identified as a teacher who deliberately chose to teach children of color, whether they were Black, or I spent 11 years teaching Indigenous children in Alaska. And now, you know, I teach a predominantly Mexican population. So, you know, deliberately choosing to teach at schools that were predominantly composed of children of color. But it was a long time before I identified as a teacher of color. And that is a completely different thing that completely changes what you do in a classroom, you know, of children. And so I would say, you know, a huge part of that was meeting Ken and Tiana and Trisha and Anna and, you know, our whole squad. God. Yeah. Seeing myself reflected in the things that they did that I was always kind of shunned or called out for. Mm-hmm. You know, for a long time, I thought, oh, I'm just being shunned because I'm progressive. And finally, I figured it out because I'm not that smart. I was like, oh my gosh, this is all happening to me because I'm Black, right? And not just this is happening to me, but I make the choices that I make as a teacher because I'm Black. And so once you identify who you are and how you come to the space because of who you are, and then you start to do that work of decolonization, you know, and all of that, it changes the whole game. And so I don't think that's just work that teachers of color need to do. That's work that teachers who are white need to do as yeah. well. You've got to figure out who you are, and you have to do the really difficult work of, especially teachers who are white, of racializing yourself and understanding what all of that means and how that impacts the way that you come into the space where you teach children. You know, this work that Kim and I do together, this, you know, Black boy lit, sometimes we call it BIPOC boy lit, depending on session that we're about to do is obviously related to Black History Month. So we're going to focus on our Black boys, but yeah, this work, like, we can't begin to even talk to, you know, people just want an answer. Like, okay, how do I do it? How do I get my kid to be, you know, my children, the students that I teach to be where your kids are? Well, first of all, you know, like, I just always want to, like, you have to do the work yourself first. Yeah. And you have to come to the table. You have to come to the classroom, the horseshoe table. Let's say that you have to come to the horseshoe. The horseshoe table, a specific way. And if you're not coming that way, then you're not going to be able to do the work. So, just had to put that out there.
No, that's wonderful. It actually ties into the next question. Is, you know, thinking about when even teaching Black boy lit, what is the most crucial piece that folks need to get right first before we start pulling all of the books off of the shelf, or, you know, that are BIPOC or stories about Black students? What is that work that they need to do first?
Oh, that's a good one. And Ms. Jay and I were talking about this today when we were prepping for our presentation next week. Ms. Jay, what one did I say? Because we have a few. I think that one of the sort of the big questions that people should think about first is the one about, is the text a counter narrative to stereotypes? I think that while there are more books being published about Black boys, we have to think really critically if they are challenging stereotypes, or if they are giving boys a different way of seeing themselves. I mean, we know Black boys well, and we know that they are complex beings, right? And so if the books that are published and the ones that we continue to buy are only telling a particular story, then we are doing damage and harm. And so as we think about the books that we make available, that we try to do and have in front of people, particularly about Black boys, we need to be thinking about providing a range, an excellent range, so they can see themselves and that others can also see them and understand them in the broad ways that we also know them.
Yeah, we talk about how, you know, we name books that are affirming our Black boys and books that help them to extend themselves and books that help them to continue to challenge themselves. When Kim and I were talking earlier, you know, I thought, you know, one of the things that's really important is to ensure that we are not just a counter narrative, but are we providing the space for children to have a radical imagination, right? And to freedom dream in our classrooms. And so part of, you know, not always presenting texts that are stereotypes, which we never want to do, actually, part of, you know, going beyond and providing counter narratives, I think, is also just giving children the space to dream.
Yes. Snaps to what both of you all said. Okay, so we are going to wrap up. This was, oh my gosh, such a great conversation. And I think that anyone listening in will have some good first steps. I heard, check yourself first. Where are you in this work? There's a lot of self-reflection that needs to take place before.
And it's like the most, I'm sorry, this is jumping, but that's the most important, yes. Right? Like we can't do anything if we don't start with ourselves first.
Definitely. Okay, so I always like to ask my guests some fun rapid fire questions just so that the listeners can get to know the not so teachery side of the guests. So I'm going to quickly ask them, and you don't have to give an explanation. You can just say what it is. All right. Don't be scared. All right. So first one, what is your favorite snack?
Oh, Miss J, you should answer that.
Cam likes to make fun of me because I eat children's food. So I really, really love like the Annie's gummies. Oh my God, so delicious. But yeah, when I visit Kim, I share snacks with her son.
Yes. So right. So it's like one-stop shopping with them. I appreciate that. I think for mine, it's a really good sour cream and onion potato chip, preferably Deep River sour cream and onion potato chips.
Yes. Okay. Those are good snacks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. So this is the next one is, what book did you start reading that it could be as a child or now? What book did you start reading that you just could not put it down until you finished it?
Oh, I probably can do sort of recent. And that was Angie Thomas's Concrete Rose.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Does really, really, really wanting to finish it, but it's really, really long. But you stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning reading every night count. Uh-huh. I'm reading 400 Souls right now. Oh my gosh, I can't put it down. Like, I was just getting my nails done and, you know, reading it on my phone, and I like got water all over my phone because I couldn't stop like flipping the pages. So it's really fantastic.
Mine was Fly Girl. I could not put down Fly Girl.
Oh yeah. I was so sad that he died.
Oh yes.
Oh,
such a great, that was one I could connect really, really easily to. Okay. Last question. This is easy. What's your favorite month of the year?
So easy. My favorite month of the year is October because that is the month of my birth and Halloween. And I was going to say pumpkin spice, but I'm really just kidding. Dr. Parker.
Oh, Miss J. No, and pumpkin ice cream and everything pumpkin. So there. So I could almost love October as much as Miss J, but I don't. Probably September though. I like the fall. And then, you know, it's like sweater season. So I'm voting for September.
The good month.
Yeah.
Well, they're close by.
I love fall. Fall clothes. Boots. Oh my goodness. I always can't wait to wear boots.
I wear them in the summer. I know my legs get hot. I don't even know why I do it. But anyway, I digress. All right. So this has been awesome. Before we close out, I want folks to be able to reach you. Where can folks find you? Any blogs that you have? I'll still put them in the show notes. But where can we find out more about your brilliant work?
I am on Twitter at @TCHKimPossible and at drkimparker.org. And you can find me with the hashtag DisruptText or BlackBoyLit.
I wish we had time to unpack the disrupt text, but we can't. We'll be here forever. But yes, please, please connect with that. That's a whole nother episode. Okay. And Miss J.
I am Artigile Teach on Twitter. And then you can find me at kinderbender.com.
Awesome. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you all so much for taking out the time to chat with me and letting all of the other educators know how to start this work. I appreciate it. And to my listeners, thank you so much for listening, and happy teaching.